Freunde des gepflegten Korbballsports, herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe unseres Korbiger-Podcasts. Schön, dass ihr wieder dabei seid zu einer Spezialaufgabe. Nachdem die WM ja jetzt endgültig auf die Philippinen gezogen ist, die Finalrunde findet ja in Manila statt. Die deutsche Nationalmannschaft spielt auch morgen gegen Lettland ihr Viertelfinale und dann hoffentlich auch ein Halbfinale gegen die USA. Mal schauen. Haben wir uns gedacht, wir schauen uns den Basketball auf den Philippinen mal genauer an. Tatsächlich handelt es sich nämlich bei den Philippinen um eins der basketballbegeistertsten Länder des Planeten. Hat man vielleicht so nicht immer auf dem Schirm, ist aber tatsächlich so. Und warum das so ist und wie sich das Ganze äußert, wissen wir natürlich nicht. Und deshalb haben wir uns Verstärkung geholt. Rafe Bartholomew war so nett, uns ein Interview zu geben. Vielen Dank dafür schon mal. Und Rafe hat einerseits früher bei Grantland gearbeitet, wo auch Zach Lowe groß geworden ist, hat andererseits schon ein Buch geschrieben mit Jackie McMullen und war selbst lange auf den Philippinen unterwegs, um zu recherchieren, hat dort ein Universitätsprojekt gehabt und im Zuge dieses Projekts hat er eine Profimannschaft begleitet, hat mit Soziologinnen und Soziologen gesprochen, mit Experten, mit Spielern, mit Trainern, hat selbst gespielt, hat mit den Menschen vor Ort gesprochen, auf der Straße und hat wirklich sich jeglichen Winkel, Blickwinkel des Basketballs auf den Philippinen und der Geschichte des Basketballs auf den Philippinen angeschaut. Er weiß also ziemlich gut Bescheid, ist auch seither wahnsinnig oft im Land gewesen, um Dokus zu drehen und spricht auch Tagalog, eine der Landessprachen. Also von daher ein Experte für den Basketball auf den Philippinen und hoffentlich ein interessantes Interview für euch. Es ist sehr ausführlich geworden, deshalb verliere ich selber jetzt ganz ungewohnt gar keine großen Worte mehr und sage einfach viel Spaß mit unserem Interview mit Rafe Bartholomew. Wobei, Moment, einen habe ich noch ganz kurz. Kleiner Disclaimer, das Interview haben wir am Montag aufgenommen, kurz nach dem Sieg Litauens gegen die USA und kurz vor der Niederlage Litauens gegen Serbien. Das heißt, nur kurz für den Kontext, am Anfang sprechen wir kurz drüber. Das war's jetzt aber wirklich und jetzt tatsächlich endgültig viel Spaß mit unserem Interview mit Rafe Bartholomew. And there he is, Rafe Bartholomew. Thank you for coming on and welcome to the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Max. I'm excited to do it.
I'm excited as well. I can't wait for your insights because you are at the World Cup at the moment in Manila, aren't you?
I am. I've been here since the beginning, I guess it's 2 weeks now, actually, to the day I got here. So I got here a few days before the tournament began, got to see the big, record-breaking crowd at the opening games at the Philippine Arena here. Yeah. And it's also just been great to be around the Philippine basketball community for me again.
Yeah, it's always like coming back for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so I first lived in the country from 2005 to 2009. And then ever since then, had been back every calendar year except one until 2020 and COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah,
and the lockdowns here were very, very strict me. It was possible to visit the country as a foreigner, but you needed to have a 2-week quarantine before you could do anything once you arrived. And that would mean like, hey, here's your vacation. Cause I'm coming from the States and we unfortunately have no vacation. But it's, use your 2 weeks, stay in a hotel and then fly back. I couldn't do it. Yeah. Anyway, I'm making up for lost time now and I'm very happy to be doing it.
It must be exciting. I mean, the crowd in the arena, like, apart from being packed, so it seems like everybody's getting really excited about the games.
Yeah, I think the folks here, the Filipino crowd, the local media, they knew that there would be big enthusiastic crowds for, of course, the Philippine team games and Team USA, and with the quarterfinals coming, the NBA players that are going to be arriving on, Germany, Slovenia, and Canada, of course. To see the Lithuanians, the traveling, the fan groups that have traveled and just taken over whole arenas at a time, they're not used to that here. Usually you don't get like people, coming from that far to attend a match. It's been great.
It's so funny because we were wondering how it's going to be because we had the European Championships last year here in Germany. And the Lithuanians, they were just going crazy. So they take over every single arena. We were like, okay, the Philippines might be a bit farther away. So let's see. But still, they're there. And they beat the United States.
I mean, I don't know if you can get farther from the Baltic states than, than where we are here in Southeast Asia. But by the looks of things, I mean, I was watching, I didn't get to watch super closely, but in Jakarta, it looked like the Latvians were also very active. So they're coming too. So it seems like the Baltic states have the best traveling fans, at least in this tournament.
For sure. They all marked their calendars and then like half the country flew all the way or halfway around the globe to watch their teams play.
And of course, the support, at least in Lithuania's case, paid off royally last night as they knocked off Team USA.
It was. Did you watch it? Did you go to the arena? Or
yes, I just. It was incredible. I guess I shouldn't sound so enthusiastic, having seen my nation's team take a loss. But as a basketball fan, it is still a pretty rare, although increasingly common, especially in World Cup play, occurrence to see Team USA take a loss. I saw somewhere it's only the 11th. Time they've lost, since 1992. And also the game was just so much fun to watch. I mean, the way that Lithuania played so beautiful, like brilliant basketball in the first half, then had to sort of gut it out throughout the entire second half, fend off runs, and the last 5 minutes, because a team of these NBA players that Team USA had could put so much pressure on this team. It was like watching the basketball version of Indiana Jones outrunning the boulder. You don't know if they're going to get there or if the boulder's going to catch up to them. And they made enough plays to pull it out.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor. Yeah. And then, I mean, I didn't manage to watch the whole game, but like first half, they could miss from three. That was just incredible.
They made their first nine three-pointers. Whoever touched it.
And that were the second half, the one by Kuzminskas, where the shot clock ran out and he was well defended by Edwards, I think, and he just made it.
Edwards knocked the ball out of his hands and he just picked it up and the shot clock was running out. He just threw it up and swish.
It might be one of those nights where as Team USA you say, okay, we should have won. We would have loved to win, but sometimes your opponent's just got it going and you can't help it.
I mean, I'm sure they want to win. Team USA especially thinks that they no matter how good the other team plays, I'm sure they still think we are, they have that American basketball exceptionalism where they think they should win regardless. But, it's easy to rationalize this one for, one, because of how well Lithuania shot and played all around. Two, the fact that they will now, it matches them up with Italy in the quarterfinals, which looks like, arguably might be an easier game for Team USA than facing Serbia. And also, if you're going to take a punch like that from a team where they're just unbeatable on that night, you'd rather do it before a knockout phase.
That is true. That was the last chance to get one like that before it having really bad consequences. So before we jump into what we're here for to talk about, I have to ask, how excited is everybody to see the legends that our Team Germany finally taking stage in Manila?
At least the folks I'm talking to, I mean, one, the baseline NBA knowledge of Filipino fans is extremely high. I mean, the awareness is up there. So the German team's NBA players, from Dennis Schroeder, Daniel Theiss, the Wagner brothers, they will be recognized and they will get their love from the fans. I think, and especially people have been just watching it and impressed at, of course, they're one of the only undefeated, one of two undefeated teams coming into the quarterfinals, and having, knocked off Australia and Slovenia definitively in that last game. There's sort of a buzz of excitement and just the idea of the folks I've talked to who are really locked into NBA basketball, the idea of seeing this other side of Dennis Schroeder's game, where he's one of these players who really whether it's because of the freedom he gets to play with, the amount of responsibility, you know, his national team gives him to score and make plays. But he's one of those guys who is, you see him and you're like, what is that from sort of an NBA centric point of view? Yeah. Fiba Dennis is special.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Fiba Paddy, and they matched up well in the game they played Australia. Like first quarter of Paddy Mills was incredible, and then Schroeder took over. Over here we're the same. It's just like he's a whole different player when he plays for the national team, and it's fun to watch. Definitely fun to watch. So, and yeah, the Philippines, they won their first game at a World Cup in 9 years against China. And Jordan Clarkson, 32 points, 20 points in roughly 4 minutes. That's not too shabby either. So how popular is he in the Philippines? Is he like a big star?
Very popular. It's I think there's always a, even though of course Jordan Clarkson is part Filipino, he has a Philippine passport, although he plays as the naturalized player because of FIBA rules. So there is always a little bit of a divide between, you know, the players who are here throughout the year or, you know, are born and raised here and then represent the country compared to, you know, those who a guy like Clarkson who comes over really for a couple of weeks at a time to play for Team Philippines. But still, because he is one of the handful of players of Filipino ancestry in the NBA and his Sixth Man of the Year campaign, those have made him an extremely popular player here. I think there's something special about the comfort level that fans here have with their local players, where it's almost like they'll go up to them and have a whole conversation, you know, and players are often really comfortable reciprocating with them every step of the way. I think they see someone like Jordan Clarkson, and because he is this elevated NBA status, they sort of put him on a pedestal, and that closeness isn't there, but just the, you know, if Jordan, put it this way, if Jordan Clarkson walked outside anywhere in the country without a full security detail, he would be surrounded by hundreds and then thousands in a matter of minutes, really.
Be like Michael Jordan in 92 in Barcelona.
Something like it. Well, we were mentioning Lithuania earlier. At the beginning of the tournament, Donatas Motiejūnas was telling a story about when he was here in 2013 for a preseason game with the Houston Rockets. And he said him and some other players went to a local, a mall in Metro Manila, not really understanding the circumstances, and they didn't call ahead or anything. They just went because they figured it's a mall. What's the big deal? And they said it shut the mall down. They had to call in. They had to call the police. They had to shut the doors, stop letting people in. Like, cause so, it gets posted on social media. Everyone starts showing up at the mall. And so this is for, this is for a handful of players. I don't think James Harden at the time, who were on the Houston Rockets. So the idea that Jordan Clarkson, who is one of the most famous NBA players here, at least to Filipino fans, he'd be a very, very big deal.
Well, that perfectly sums up why I'm so happy that you came on, because that basketball excitement in Philippines, I just read about it before, and even before the World Cup, like last season or the season before, when Clarkson and Jalen Green first played against each other as two players of Filipino descent. So, and I figured that's really interesting. I read about it. And what I want to talk about. But before we jump into that, I'd like to talk to you about basketball and yourself for a bit, because as someone from New York, if you travel to the Philippines to study their basketball culture, there sure is a deep appreciation for the game itself, I think, I suppose. So I was wondering, so if you could sit down and have dinner with basketball, what would you tell it? What would you tell the game?
Man, that's tricky. Honestly, if I were, the anthropomorphized version of basketball sitting across from me, I have to start off probably being thankful. My own experience with the game is primarily and still is as someone who loves, you know, sort of playing it as much as anything else. And mm-hmm. then on top of that, has been lucky enough to figure out some way to stick around it as I grew up and stopped, you know, having any sort of meaningful career. But I still feel best about myself when I am able to, you know, get outside or to a gym in, you know, the morning or at some point of day. Usually, you know, at this point, I'm 41, just to get shots up but to feel like I still have a touch, to feel like the ball still belongs in my hands and it's not a foreign object. If I do that, I feel better, you know, I feel better about myself in every single way. And it's the only thing that I've continually done, you know, it's been a constant part of my life since the time I was about 8 years old. You know, I played other sports on and off. There were periods in when I was younger, when I was super fascinated with, you know, film history. And I had a little like 18 months where I was interested in art history. And for 5 years, I was like a really like hardcore New York, like 90s underground hip hop kid. And then, you know, and I still, and interested in all of these little things, but they've come and gone in terms of like how much time and space they occupy in my life. Basketball is the only one that's been a constant throughout. So I think I start by just saying thank you. You know, that's really the thing that I have to express to it. And then if there are any secrets beyond that, I'd love to know.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to get started. Yeah, it'd be similar with me. But what you say is like for you, knowing the game in New York, having played in gyms, having played on the streets, having played in the Philippines, to you, what is like the heart and soul of the game that you've experienced and that maybe you feel for yourself?
And I think that was, I mean, that coming from New York to Manila, that was one of the things that really struck me is that, especially in that time, we New Yorkers viewed ourselves, you could still sort of make the case that, or at least kid ourselves into thinking that New York was the Mecca. We were, you know, we had some special relationship with basketball that didn't quite exist in other places. And that we still had the myth of the New York City point guard was still a thing. And I mean, now you look at it, it's rare. It's becoming almost rare to find players from the New York City area who make it into, or at least New York City proper. The area produces mm-hmm. a lot of great talent. Yeah. The city itself, it's usually the kids who get out of the city by the time they're 12, who will go on to big careers. But anyway, but when I grew up, in the 90s, when it seemed like everyone played basketball, whether they were good or not, everybody played at whatever level they could, in middle school and high school and recreational leagues. And it was our recreation center was where everyone went after school to play pickup games. And it was, you know, part of my, I was one of these kids dribbling around on my way to school, on the subways, and traveling with, you know, the teammates I traveled around the city with were my closest friends. And we spent, you know, all day, every day together. And so, coming from that sort of heated basketball environment to the Philippines and honestly being, almost humbled by how much more deep that connection felt to so many people I was observing and interacting with here, and how they played even more than us. They had even more courts on the streets than us. They would play in the kind, you know, we think, oh, we're New York. We play outside. We have playgrounds. We're where street ball began, all this stuff. But I come to Manila and see folks doing things that we would never sort of consider, like playing in flip-flops, playing in bare feet, yeah. building their own basketball hoops, stuff that in New York, you know, like in New York, it was like we would pat ourselves on the back because we brought our own nets to the court to hang up on the rims. So it was humbling, and also, of course, you know, deeply moving to see that represented in another and in some ways even more passionate way, all the way on the other side of the world. Especially because before I came here, I didn't really know much about Philippine basketball. I did apply for a scholarship to study it, but you know, up until it was sort of a moment where I read about it in a book, and I was like, oh my God, this is a thing, this exists. To be able to come over and see it and learn about it for myself was just incredible.
You talked about, because them playing barefoot and flip-flops, that's like probably the picture that really sucks in everybody's heads who sees it for the first time and hears about it for the first time. But is it sometimes, because today, since basketball is so marketable and we've got all those, like, yeah, we've got the signature shoes and that, it's so much stuff around it. And is it for you, to you who's been there, or who came there like 17 years ago, 18 years ago for the first time, is like that they still live the essence of the game?
I think both exist here. You'll find both. There is because there is this outsized passion for the game. The big basketball brands are all very active here. Nike, Anta, the Chinese shoe company, just had Klay Thompson and Kevin Looney in town. You name it. The NBA has had an office in Manila for a decade now. There is that sort of, top level, slick size, slick professional, where the most elite play happens, but also, it also feels like, it can be like the furthest removed from the grassroots sort of love of the game. I think the vast majority of people living in this country, because they aren't, the average Filipino is still, frankly, does not, go out and buy Nike shoes, at least, official branded Nike shoes, but they do play basketball, and they might have, sneakers that are shared among a family, or, handed down, or, I leave my sneakers behind every time I leave the country. And I go back to a neighborhood and see, people still wearing the same shoes from, 2008 sometimes.
Oh, wow.
People find a way, and that side of things is really, really moving to see and experience and also play among. It's that sort of basketball really is a daily activity for much of the nation here, where once once the sun starts to go down around 4 p.m., 4:30 in the afternoon, people are going to show up at basketball courts all over the country when it's cool enough to play and play for 2 hours. Same thing in the morning before work, people are going to show up for those shifts and get in there. You see and in the summertime, which here is, in March and April, neighborhood leagues, where it will be, the local government will sponsor a tournament for, different age groups, and seeing everyone show up to watch their own family members play, watching that kind of like community around basketball, that sort of back to the root soul of the game is very, very alive in a strong way here, and exists, I think, all those folks who are playing and really just playing for love and because it's what they've always done and it's a part of life, they still are following the NBA. They're still are following the local professional league, the PBA, and the big college leagues here. And they know about the sort of the fancy stuff, but it's still, more important is the sort of the day-to-day just, being able to play.
So everybody it seems like everybody has a touch point with basketball, either playing themselves or have a family member or a friend playing and they watch them. Is that true? Like basketball kind of gets into every household in the Philippines, almost every household.
I found that to be largely true. One thing I always liked, you know, when I was doing some research on Philippine basketball, I would meet with professors at the University of the Philippines and some of the, mm-hmm. the best private schools in Metro Manila, like Ateneo de Manila and De La Salle. And they would, these were sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists. And these were often sort of background interviews to learn as much about Philippine society as about basketball specifically, because I was trying to sort of get a grasp on the bigger picture as well. Yeah. And I, inevitably, you know, the interviews would always begin with these professors who don't specifically study basketball, saying, "I don't know why you're talking to me. My work is about something completely different than basketball. This seems kind of silly." And then within 10 minutes, they're telling me some story about how, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't really like to play, but in my neighborhood, I was always the 10th person for a 5-on-5, and everyone knew where I lived, so they'd come over my window and I'd be, you know, reading or doing something I was more interested in, and they'd say, "You have to come play with us right now." And so I played all the time, you know, and it's like, one of the most mind-blowing interviews I had was with an anthropologist at the University of the Philippines who was, has done a lot of work researching, you know, Philippine gender and sexuality, mm-hmm. and he was explaining to me that in his research he had spoken to young men coming out as gay in the Philippines who found that they were one of the ways they sort of came to understand their sexual identity was through basketball and sort of that contact with other men. And, you know, it's not like this is not in some creepy way, but just, it's like that light bulb moment, mm-hmm. for many of the people he interviewed came on a basketball court for them. And it's just sort of basketball, it finds its way into parts of Philippine society in almost any way. It's like water finding the cracks.
Your studies, are they turned into a book, Pacific Rims, that came out in 2010?
Well, so the first edition was 2010, and then the paperback came out in 2011.
Yeah, it's highly recommended. So if you guys want to read it or thinking about it, do it. And you also did a documentary or a few documentaries, Hoop Nation, for example. And there you traveled to different areas, spoke to different people again. And there was one sentence that kind of stuck to me that was, you talked to a Philippine journalist, Tessa Jasminez, mm-hmm. and she said that the game matches the Filipino spirit. It's their hope because it expresses their soul. How did you understand the sentence when she said it? And what would you consider being the Filipino soul? How did you kind of picture it for yourself?
The way I understood it when Tessa Jasminez was saying that was the improvisational aspect of basketball, the opportunity to, you know, get the ball and do something spectacular and unexpected with it, and both score points or find an open man or make a great play, but also do it in a way that that captivates the people around you, that looks cool. Mm-hmm. That is you see that in a lot of aspects of Philippine pop culture and society, you know, and the dancing, karaoke, some of the other sort of beloved pastimes, ways that people, yeah. Socialize in the country, you know, if you go the variety shows that are on television in the middle of the day here, often when they bring someone out of the crowd and start interviewing them, they will say, you know, in Tagalog, you know, "What is your talent?" You know, mm-hmm. and it's like, "Are you a good singer? Are you a good dancer? What is it?" You know, and basketball is another avenue for that kind of expression. Now, I think in the, you know, you'll also hear critics who will say, and I think with some good reason, that that emphasis on flair and sort of one-on-one play and being cool in Philippine basketball, which is a real thing, does not exactly help them when the country goes out and tries to compete on the world stage. if you saw the Philippines play in this World Cup, you probably would agree. But it is it still is a way, sort of, it's still a major way that people experience the game. And I know, and also I remember times, one of the ways that people access the internet here, now it's all, now everything's on people's phones, but maybe 10 years ago you would see on the street in some areas, there'd be little kiosks where you could pay five pesos, which is about 10 cents in the United States. So similar to euros. And get 5 minutes of internet, and you'd walk by. I remember walking by a row of these, and every single one was a like a teenage boy watching Allen Iverson highlights. And long after AI had retired, but it's like that worship of the guy who can break you down and score is definitely real here. And I think Mamtesa was sort of hinting at that self expression, the excitement, the ability to show off what makes you special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Iverson, I mean, he was like the David small. Amongst Goliaths. Yeah, he was small, so probably Filipinos can relate there as well.
The underdog, yes. So,
yeah. And yeah, that makes total sense. And he was amazing. I mean, he was, that one shiny moment. I mean, you talk in your book, and when you talked about your book in the past, you also talk about the poverty in real life in the Philippines. And you also talked about the team, the national team, not really being that successful recently on the international stage. More losses than wins, and still the people have that excitement for the game and find their ways like in their everyday lives. So can that be, in your opinion, knowing the country and knowing the game there, can that be like a sort of metaphor? So there's more to sport than winning and losing. I mean, you just said so that one shining moment there. And there is also more to life, to a certain degree, of course, than having and not having.
Yes. I mean, I certainly agree. This was like in turn there every I think, honestly, every time there's a world basketball event that the Philippines participates in and, wins one game and, or doesn't win a game at all in some years. People publish columns in the newspapers that say, we shouldn't be doing this. We're not tall. Although the Philippine team is kind of got tall out of, or at least has a couple of very tall big men, could use some help on the wing anyway. But in general, there's this, it's an old argument around here that, because on average, Filipinos are not among the tallest people in the world. And actually on average are among the smaller people in the world. Then basketball is not the sport for them. Maybe, and also the funny thing about these arguments is they always say, we should go play football, soccer instead.
Yeah.
As if it's easy to just break onto the world scene in football because you're not tall. And it's like, have you ever watched the rest of the world play?
And then you're fine.
But if you think basketball is competitive, watch out. Indeed, I think that because one of the really amazing things I think about Philippine basketball is it is at this point so deeply ingrained in people's lives and in society that it's sort of immune to being knocked off of its pedestal, its role in people's lives by the national team no longer performing particularly well at the World Cup, or not being indisputably the best team in Asia as the country was in, say, the first half of the 20th century, the beginning, sort of the early era of basketball. That played a big role. That early success played a big role in why the game became so popular here. But then it sort of skipped, you know, it crossed over into people's bloodstreams. And now it's really, people love it because it's what they do. It's because it's what their dads did and their uncles did and their grandparents. And it's where, you know, their mom, you know, sold food outside of the basketball court and they were there every day watching. And it's just, it's because it's more, it's grown beyond wins and losses now. And there's nothing wrong with that because you see the role that it plays in people's lives and returning to the issue of, you know, the relative poverty of a lot of people have to live with here. It's, you know, the basketball is certainly not like a cure all for anything. It's not going to make, you know, not going to fix anyone's lives or some of the problems that the country faces. It is, it's something that for, you know, when you see the day-to-day role it has in people's lives and as a sort of a, you know, something that just brings that much joy to so many people, through playing that they can access in their own backyards or in their own neighborhoods, wherever they live, that is, that, you know, that's pretty inspiring.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you talked about like the first half of the 20th century where the national team was doing really well on the international stage. And reading your book, I thought it was the history of basketball in the Philippines was quite interesting because it basically started off as being more than just a sport or just a game almost from the beginning. So how did it help shape the nation, or what did it do to the Philippines, or for the Philippines?
Well, I mean, in the beginning, I think it's probably accurate to say to the Philippines, because of course, you know, I mean, the history of basketball in the Philippines begins with, you know, American colonialism in the Philippines.
Yeah,
you know, the Philippines was a Spanish colony for, you know, 300 years until the Spanish-American War in 1898. Then the United States came in and for a while made it seem like this might be some war of liberation, but then decided, no, actually, we'll keep it. And administered, you know, colonial rule onto the country for another 50 years until World War II began. And throughout that, you know, so at the beginning of the American colonial period, basketball was introduced along with other sports and athletic endeavors through the patently, you know, just like at the, you know, whatever they were thinking at the time, but, you know, very easy for us today to call clearly racist idea of civilizing people, you know, who needed to be civilized as if the society they already had was uncivilized. So basketball was one of the things that was introduced. Oddly enough, baseball was something that at the time the United States government thought was more important, would be more popular because it was more popular in the States. But that early connection with basketball, basically the Philippines competitively got a head start on certainly the rest of Asia and much of the rest of the world in basketball because it was made part of public school curriculum here in 1911. There was a Manila YMCA that was holding tournaments in as early as 1904. The sport became very popular in the universities in Manila right away, and it was for the same reasons that you know, football has spread in other countries, at least compared to American baseball, where, you know, it takes less. You can play it. You can play versions of basketball in a very small amount of space with just one hoop. You can play it by yourself if you're just dribbling and shooting. It was easier to make basketball courts and playgrounds in the country. It's easier to play indoors, which was very important here in the Philippines, where half the year it's a monsoon season, and the other half of the year it's you know, hotter than hell. So people do not want to be running around outside at midday here. Being an indoor sport really benefited the growth of it as well. And And then because the Philippines got this head start in all of the early national, international competitions in Asia, you know, the precursors to the Asian Games, the what, you know, the Asian basketball championships that are now that turned into FIBA Asia, the Philippines was undefeated for about 30 years and then, mm-hmm. you know, would lose only undefeated in terms of winning the gold medals. They mm-hmm. may have taken losses along the way. And then, you know, still the clear dominant force for another until about 1960. So through all of those, and during that time, in addition to people watching basketball players perform so well and bring glory to their people, the country was also arguing for and eventually earning its taking its independence from the United States, which happened in 1948, and basketball was one of the early sort of an early thing that people rallied around. You could watch the Filipino mm-hmm. team play in the first, you know, in the 1936 Olympics. In the you could watch the Philippine team playing. I mean, we already had nationhood at that time, but 1954 is sort of the golden moment, or I guess bronze moment for Philippine basketball, because it's the only Asian nation to have medaled at a World Championships mm-hmm. in the 1954 Rio de Janeiro Games. So it's, all of those little successes built a ton of pride in basketball that is sort of hard to imagine for younger Filipinos now, because it's like, well, people know that, well, we aren't actually, the best in the world at this anymore. It's just something we do and it's a part of our lives. But back for a long time, they could say, we were at that Olympics and beat the silver, in 1936, at least beat the silver medal team before the medal round, and just happened to lose to Team USA before they got, to the knockouts, or when they got to knockouts, sorry. It was, basketball helped. It was sort of an early example of nation building through basketball, or mm-hmm. basketball at least aiding a nation building effort that of course had to be, accompanied by real policy and government and institutions. But basketball being a soft power value that added to that. And I think you saw that, the other examples that come immediately to mind later in history are things like, Lithuania coming out of the Soviet Union and the 1992 Olympics. And I guess that's been one of the really wonderful stories, at least for us here watching in Manila, the group phases of the World Cup was South Sudan, a nation mm-hmm. that's 11 years old, qualifying for the Olympics and being just a really, really strong team. They had Puerto Rico beat and sort of collapsed in their first game. If they had won that one, they're, at least make it through to the second group stage. And who knows what they might have done there, but still they made it to the Olympics. They'll be in Paris next year. That's incredible for a country that young. And, I just sort of imagine, I guess watching them, I actually did imagine like, well, I wonder if this was what it was like to be here in 1936 or 1954 and seeing, and seeing the Philippines have that same kind of feeling like we just did this for our country and we're here. Take us seriously.
You also say in your book that, like, under Ferdinand Marcos, basketball was among the few things that was really allowed to be on TV. And then there was this poll in, I think, 1997, where it's like 83% of men said that basketball was their favorite sport and 64% of women. Is that still valid today? I mean, it's been 26 years since that poll. Do you think that is still valid?
I think that if it were polled by favorite sports, it would still be up there. I don't think it will have dipped much. I think that one thing you notice, and this is something I feel like I've seen all around, certainly in the United States, probably exists to some extent throughout the world, is with mass media, with gaming, with the amount of different ways that people can entertain themselves now. Basketball no longer has that sort of what, like you mentioned, what was essentially an artificial hold on the Filipino imagination that was created during during Ferdinand Marcos Sr.'s presidency, then, which he then declared martial law and turned into a dictatorship that, you know, from the 1970s until 1986, during that period, basketball was, PBA was on television three nights a week. And it was, there was only one state channel at the time, and you'd get your, you'd get news, you'd get the whatever passed for the news, under a strongman regime. And you'd get movies, you'd get soap operas, you'd get variety shows, and you'd get basketball. And it was basically the only thing that was on. So who knows how the sport may have developed differently under more open conditions. It's weird to sort of look back on it and be like, that was a really great days for basketball, when truth, it should not be viewed as a golden era for the nation. It did really cement basketball as one of the only things people love to do. These days you do see, you don't see as much part. I notice it more in the States than here. But there, it's very dramatic, where you don't see kids playing basketball in the streets in the United States as much anymore. Mm-hmm. It is, it's very organized. You have to join a club and practice. And I see young, 12, 13-year-old American kids who already have personal trainers working on, skill development with them. It's like, I'm sure you're improving at these skills, but to what end? We don't need, we don't all need this. Just, it'd be nicer to just play. But I mean, that's an old way of looking at things. I don't know, who knows? That exists to some extent here, where, there's just more things to do. There's more things on TV. There are more basketball leagues to watch. People can watch the NBA now, not just the PBA. They also watch, they also watch Filipino players playing in other Asian leagues, and it's all a lot more fragmented, which I think has been a challenge for the local professional league to adjust to, because you're throughout most of your existence, you can just sort of coast to being the biggest game in town, and now all of a sudden there's all kinds of competition, and like big old venerable institutions often are, they can be a little bit slow to adjust.
Have they adjusted in a way, or are they still struggling, the PBA?
I think if you read sort of online commentary, they're always struggling. The truth is, the league's the league's television ratings, the attendance, they're actually up compared to, say 5 years ago. They bounced back pretty nicely after the pandemic, when they weren't able to stage much, any kind of basketball in the country at all. At least on a, sort of organized level. It's actually pretty healthy in those terms, but it doesn't feel, the vibe is not the same. The vibe is that, it's mostly, it's kind of like a lumbering old thing. I think younger generations do like, whether it's a fresher product or just youthful rebelliousness or some mixture of all of that, they're like, well, forget your thing, forget your league, dad, I'll watch the NBA instead, or I'll watch the local college kids. This is cooler than that older product. I think there's a little bit of that. The PBA, I think, had, you see its initial reaction to sort of losing some local players to other leagues in Asia, in Japan and Korea. Their initial reaction was almost comically protectionist. Like they said, well, any player who does this is going to be persona non grata forever. Like, you can never come back and play here. Okay. It's like, is this even legal? And that lasted for about a week until someone talked them down. And they're like, oh, well, you know, and they keep sort of ratcheting down the penalties that they, mm-hmm. that they're trying to enforce on players just sort of, you know, going out and pursuing their own professional ambitions. And you know, it's unfortunate that they sort of have to start from such a sort of aggressive tone, but yeah. You see that, you know, and I'm not exactly, I don't know that I consider myself like a free market evangelist, but in this case, you see the market sort of forcing the PBA to adjust in a more, what we would consider a more level manner. Like they're saying, okay, well, actually, you know, let's allow players to come back and forth. Until recently, there was no such thing as free agency in the PBA. Your mother team controlled your rights until they renounced your rights as a player. So they could, you at the end of your contract, if they didn't choose to sign you or trade you, you couldn't play anywhere else. You were still just there.
Oh, they could just keep you or just like keep you from playing at all.
Exactly. Yes. There were not many cases of that happening. It was, you know, it was a sort of, it existed in sort of this gentleman's agreement zone where they're like, we're not actually going to do that, but they would threaten it if a guy would, right, exactly. Yeah. If all of a sudden the player were being a pain in their butt, they weren't afraid to at least, throw that threat out. So the PBA has created, free agency, although it's still like after 7 years only, and there's still some pretty heavy regulations on it, but still it's there. You see them moving in a direction towards the rest of the world. I think a lot of fans here would like to see them move there faster, but it is like I said, big institutions don't always move at the speed of the rest of society.
True, they take their time. So the first time you got in touch with the PBA was when you moved to the Philippines, but your first game, so first being like being used to the game in the United States and then get there, what were your first impressions of the arena, of the fans, of the game, or everything that was taken on the court?
I remember actually my first thought was I was shocked at sort of how the game was played because it was the pace, it was so fast paced, it was so run and gun, and in a lot of ways disorganized. Like it was like, oh my God, these guys are just running up and down. Like I remember there was one and you know, this was just small sample size theater, as we say. But there was, you know, a sequence where, you know, the teams went back and forth maybe for, you know, three possessions, you know, missing three pointers off the backboard. And I was like, where the hell am I? What is going on? It was just some guys who weren't great shooters rushing shots. And then, you know, it turns out that they're, you know, the league was, you know, you watch enough of the league and it's like, oh no, there are guys who can shoot. There are guys who can't, you know, it looks like basketball we're familiar with. But for a first game, I was like, oh my God, what am I watching here? And the other thing that I noticed during some of those wilder moments of that game was that the crowd seemed to specifically like that. It was like, it was like the cheers and almost the laughter rising up in the arena when just like, you know, zany things would happen. We're like, oh man, it is an air ball. Whoa. You know, instead of like a come on, man, get it together. It was like, whoa, he kicked the ball. It was almost like you could hear the circus music in your head going like
an exciting moment.
That was not a true representation of the league or sort of the quality of play. But I remember parts of that as a first impression, I was like, oh my God, what is this? But then also, you know, I think I noticed the sort of cross section of society you saw among the fans, where, you know, you could see that. I mean, I remember seeing nuns in the crowd and, you know, a commissioner's row of like clearly sort of big time people. And, you know, a couple, sort of weird foreign American or German or British or whoever. I don't even know if they knew why they were there, but, you know, someone gave them tickets and they showed up and they're having a ball. And just sort of, it was this, you know, seeing the way that it really did attract a wide range of pretty much everyone in Metro Manila and you could say at least a reflection of the entire country in that way, inside one arena.
So at the style of play, you said more run and gun, fast. Has that changed in any way, or is it still the same? So, I mean, yeah, obviously they are, the home players are smaller, so they probably play faster, but is it still the same? Is it a bit more, have they adapted in a way or changed something?
There's some, you know, of course, yes. I think that, you know, I think that observers, especially, if you're used to watching, the top tier leagues in Europe, it probably looks still a bit, you know, it looks like PBA basketball can look like a ragged version of the NBA, kind of. Mm-hmm. Except maybe the NBA, you know, 10 years ago. the NBA that was a little less with a little less of the pace and space, or a little less, a lot of the pace and not so much of the space. But there are, I mean, like anywhere else, there are teams that, you know, there are teams and coaches that really, really emphasize defense and are very successful that way and manage to sort of play a much slower pace than you see in other international leagues now, and can be very successful that way. One thing that has been in I'd say over the past decade in the PBA has been the dominance of, you know, one particular player, Junmar Fajardo, who did play on the national team and played very well in a couple games. Had some trouble keeping up with the big men of Italy, who stretched him out pretty bad and were hitting a lot of open shots because he doesn't like to step out of the lane. But had a magnificent game in the opener against Dominican Republic. Anyway, Junmar has won 6 MVPs in the last decade, and and some of the years he didn't win, it was because he missed large portions of a season due to injury. It was apparent watching him match up against, you know, Bruno Fernando and Angola and other international big men in this tournament. He is a very good old school back to the basket big, and he's enormous. He can really, really bang. and again, with a very good touch, great hands. He used to really run the floor. He was really a problem then. Now he sort of takes his time. To have a player like that, a big, that good and skilled, at least inside in the Philippines, really changed the floor balance for the entire league. Where you can't, in the rest of the world, you know, a great low post big man is nice to have, but it's not necessarily you're not necessarily going to be guaranteed to play like in the finals or winning championships every season with that. Here he was, because he was just that dominant, and there was no local player who could match up with him. He would attract double and triple teams, pass out of them, and the rest of his and had players around him who could really make plays and shoot out of those opportunities. And they were just they won six straight. All Filipino championships, which is the portion of the season devoted to just Filipino rosters without players from outside. So it was interesting. Basically, for, you know, much of this last decade, you saw a low post game thriving here in a way that I think, you know, it was simultaneously being de-emphasized in NBA basketball, but And people sometimes, you know, who were fans of both the PBA and NBA would watch people and say, look, we're still throwing it into the post, but it's like, but you'd have to remind them, guys, this is not the NBA. You basically have 90s Shaq here, you know, relative to who's guarding him and his ability to get whatever he wants. Yeah. Like, yeah. It is a good play. Yes, it's not a three-pointer. If you throw it to this guy, I guarantee you his points per possession are very, very high. He is a very, very efficient force down there. Like, those are good plays for this league. Of course, you know, the issue is then when you scale that out to the rest of the world and you're playing and he's matched up with other guys who can at least handle his size. Mm-hmm. And players are not yet, and his teammates aren't necessarily adapted to it yet. Then it made it harder to compete on an international level. But you know what? Before, there's a lot of, we've been mentioning the Philippines, you know, performance in the international tournaments in this the past World Cup. 1-4 is not, you know, people here are not satisfied with it. The team, its coaches were not satisfied. The head coach has already announced that he's stepping aside.
Okay.
So it's not viewed as a success, but at the same time, the rest of Asia in this World Cup did not exactly show out other than Japan, which had a great tournament. But everyone else was either 0-5 or 1-4. I guess Lebanon had two wins. But you know, I think Philippines could have beaten Iran too. In any case, all I mean is that like they're pretty much right in their neighborhood in terms of, you know, the rest of the world right now. I don't think that they fell behind. It just because the love of the game is so strong here, people want more.
Understandably, you mentioned his height. It's a rare thing, and it's like what I found interesting. I mean, you got really great insights off the PBA when you were following along a team, the Alaska Aces, during your time there. So you were with the team, so you saw everything. And then there was this rule, because you just mentioned that they've got part of the season where they only play local players, and then there's a part of the season where they are allowed to bring in foreign players. And so there was only one player they could bring in from the States, and there was a certain limit to their height, wasn't there?
Yes, and it changes. This is one of the unique aspects of professional basketball in the Philippines, which is, I mean, endlessly confusing when you're trying to write about it. Because, you know, so a season here is divided into what they call conferences. And throughout most of the history of the league, there have been three conferences per season. However, and this is including during the time that I was specifically embedded with a team in 2007, there were only two conferences per season. So, they're back to three conferences now. Why do they do three conferences? Because the PBA wants to be running, and it does, 11 months out of the year. There is not much of an off season for players here, which might be a problem in another way. The PBA is running 11 months out of the year. One long season would be pretty unbearable. I mean, you see how what the 82 game NBA season feels like these days. The PBA playing a 100 game season would be insane. So what do? They split it up into three different conferences. Also, when does the league get the most revenue at the gate and on TV? Playoffs and finals. So it allows them to triple up their playoff revenues. There's a method to their madness here, even though it's pretty confusing from an outside point of view. So one of those conferences has always been what they call an all-Filipino conference. So that is, you cannot bring in a foreign player at all. Then in the other conferences, the league will set a height limit that changes. It is usually around 6'6 for what they call the small conference.
Which is shooting guard size in the NBA, kind of, right?
Yes.
So six, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they want us, and for a long time, that was a preference because they like to get those that kind of player in the league. A wing player who can create for himself. Athletic, dunk the ball, do, you know, highlights, you know, basically, yeah. I mean, this, it predates Michael Jordan. So it's not entirely because Michael Jordan was 6'6", yeah. But, it is basically because that size player often, delivers the best sort of package of basketball yeah. highlight and skill where like he can handle, he can shoot, maybe, you know, he could probably shoot it a little bit. He can go to the basket and finish. And there's a lot of variety. You can get a guy, you can get an undersized power forward type. You can get a straight shooter type, you know, so that's why they liked it. They also would have a conference where the height limit was much taller, either 6'11", 7 feet, unlimited, sometimes 6'10". Sometimes they get pretty exotic with it where they're, there have been historically a few times where you were allowed to bring in two imports per team for a conference, and they were allowed to mix and match however they chose, a combined height limit of, it would be, I think, something like 13 feet or, you know, 12 foot 10. So it's like, you know, you can get a really, you can get a really tall guy, a really short guy. Yeah. Yeah. Right. If you find a Shante Rogers or a Earl Boykins, then maybe you can bring in a 7-footer, you know. And so they've always messed around with that. And it creates different, you know, obviously puts different constraints on each different conference. Throughout history, the most prestigious has always been the All-Filipino, because that's the one where that's sort of viewed as proof of who's the best among the locals. Mm-hmm. The other ones, you know, the best local teams usually show up in the finals or near it, but they ultimately are decided by, you know, who gets the best performance from their foreign player.
With the height limit, why are they really strict about it? How they like check whether the player really was within the limit?
That has evolved over time. That was one of my favorite one of my favorite things I ever got to write was looking into that, because I just, you know, talking, I would start interviewing players and coaches about, hey, who are some of the best foreign players who came through here? And they would say, oh, well, this guy was great, but, you know, he played for this team and they had connections. So they were always able to get in a taller import. He was always like two inches taller and all this stuff. And so I said, well, how did they sneak him in? Did they just pay someone off? And they, no, he passed the test, but so there's an official way. The PBA measures each player after he arrives in the country. Until the mid 2000s. So the first 30 years of the league's existence, they measured those players standing up against a wall in the PBA office. And there are pictures of it you see in the history books, guys standing up there. There would be guys and they have like four different team officials, like, you know, standing on chairs to get up to measure the top of him and, you know, rulers and measuring sticks. And it's like this whole scene. And that was how they did it for a long time. And there was a combination. First, when I asked about how they got guys to be shorter than they really were, team coaches would mention, like, and they believed it with all their hearts, that they had methods of physically shrinking a player before his measurement. That if you got a guy, you know, into the country and you knew you had 24 hours to shrink him, you could, you know, put him in a sauna so that he would become the idea being that the discs in your vertebra, you know, the cush, the pads there would become dehydrated and each shrink by just a few millimeters, and then it would add up, or you would make him do a lot of shoulder press exercises to try and compress the spine. You'd want him to be measured at the end of the day after he'd been walking around and, like, you know, and again, compressed the spine throughout, rather than when he first wakes up in the morning. Or you would, you know, you would have him, you know, again, run around, sweat a lot, do something like that to try and they say, oh yeah, we could easily get him to shrink an inch or two that way. And then, you know, I remember calling doctors and saying, is there any truth to this? And like, in theory, perhaps, but the difference would be, you know, in 1 millimeter total. This is like, okay. You are not going to see, this is not a real thing. These were old wives' tales, sort of folk remedies. But what it turned out they were doing is that they would just, you know, you're standing against a wall, so the player would just either sort of try and angle his back a little bit, slouch a little bit against the wall to get under, you know that I have to get about an inch shorter or 2 inches shorter. Or in some cases, there were guys that would bend their legs a little bit, you know, and just say, no, this is how I stand. My knees don't lock. I'm sorry. This is it. And for a while, and I saw a picture and I couldn't believe it, the PBA actually hired well, they didn't hire specifically, but they had employees then get on their knees and try to physically press players' knees in to lock them out, to straighten them. It's like this whole circus trying to get accurate measurements. And throughout the history of that, some players were able to sneak in, despite being a little bit taller than the limit. Eventually, I think around 2004, 2005, the league dawned on them that they could ask the players to lay down, and then it would be much easier to get an accurate measurement. And it's been pretty straightforward ever since then. But there was an interesting little lag period there from 2004 to about 2007 where, some teams like to bring back players they've worked with before because, you know, he was good in the locker room, you know, good effort, showed up, we liked him, he was just really talented, he's available again, we had him 3 years ago, we almost won, let's get him back. They started doing that, and in a couple of cases, guys who had been 6'5 or 6'6, 2 years before were now 6'7 and couldn't play and they had to send them home. So there's a whole crazy history of this in the PBA.
you saw it from up close, as you said, and you also saw how like foreign players interacted with their team, with their coaches, and how they some of them had to compete against other players that the team might want to bring in instead of them. To replace them. And so what made it so difficult for foreign players? I mean, there were some pretty big names, or fairly big names, with Darvin Ham, now Lakers coach, or Dickie Simpkins, Scott Burrell, who had won championships with the Bulls. How was the experience for a foreign player to be part of an PBA team and get adjusted to the way they play, to the way they trained, and to the way they had to perform on the court? And what were the expectations for them?
Absolutely. I mean, the expectations throughout much of the league's history have basically been to get buckets, to score a lot, to whatever you do. I mean, one of the two or three, I think, foreign players who are in the Hall of Fame here now. His name is Norman Black. He still lives in the Philippines and actually he was coaching in the PBA until last year. And I saw him this week calling World Cup games for local television, doing play by play analysis. But anyway, I remember one of the things he told me, one of his rules for himself. And when he was a coach in the PBA, what he would tell his imports, he would say, play to win, make sure, play to win, play a team game, make sure you get your numbers. Because, even if, the one thing, at least at the end of the, sort of in a bottom line way, he always understood that if he could point to his box score and say, look, this is here, I did this, it was a form of job protection, or at least was a way to stave off being replaced with another import, which is something that teams here can be very, very ruthless in doing. I mean, they will replace a guy after one game. I've seen players who were averaging, you know, high 30s in points replaced in the middle of the playoffs because a player who the team suspected might be better was available. You know, just all kinds of, you know, basically, you know, the teams look at it as, you know, you're a hired gun and we will pay you handsomely and treat you well for as long as we need you. And they don't really, you know, and there's, it's pretty emotionless beyond that. And I think a lot of the players do understand that, you know, it's not like playing international basketball for a lot of these American guys. If they've been around, they've, you know, they've had experiences in other countries that aren't that different. But the Philippines has a quick trigger, and one of the ways for those players to sort of protect themselves was always to at least make sure they got their points and their rebounds. And they'll stick around longer if they win, but sometimes even if you winning in a lot of cases proved to not be enough for some teams and managers, where they would be like, well, we're 6-0, but our import isn't producing, so maybe if we get an import who scores even more, we'll be even better. And, yeah, you know, this is usually not coming from the coach. This is coming from someone above who does not understand how that player is contributing to winning. But unfortunately, that kind of influence can be around, or historically has been. The other thing that can make it difficult, so there are big expectations for scoring. And, you know, you mentioned Darvin Ham is one of the big name players who came out here and fizzled out rather quickly. He only played three games. He was brought in the middle of the playoffs to sort of lead one of the marquee franchises in the league to a championship. And he was coming off of the Detroit Pistons championship team that he had played on. And so it was sort of, and people were like, oh, look, here he is on the cover of Sports Illustrated in college, breaking a backboard with a dunk. He's going to do that in this league. No one will guard him. The expectations got extremely high. But, you know, Darvin Ham was coming off of a career in the NBA where he had been a defensive role player. You know, he wasn't time to score a lot, and to immediately be thrown into the PBA and teams looking, you know, teammates throwing it to him and being like, okay, Darvin, go get it. You know, and he's like, why don't we just play basketball? I think that, you know, if he had come in earlier in the year and they had time to sort of figure each other out, I bet he could have been very successful. They would have figured out a way for him to sort of, you know, score within a system and then also do all the other things that made him a championship contributor in the NBA. But on short notice in the PBA, they didn't really know, not everyone just was looking at each other like, what do you want me to do here? I remember on his way out of the country, he was pretty frustrated. And the other thing that always happens with foreign players here is they're tested in strange ways by the local sort of enforcer defenders who will pull out all kinds of tricks to try and, you know, make them angry, get them out of their games, because it's sort of accepted that a lot of these players are extraordinarily talented, great scorers, who, you know, even your best defender might not be able to stop. So what's one of the ways they try and even up the score a little bit is by, you know, hacking them, you know, doing just weird, holding them in weird ways that'll drive them crazy, like, you know, holding their fingers, holding, you know, just pinching, you know, really cheap, like little jabs to the stomach, like things that, I mean, they're dirty. They're legit dirty.
Things you don't like, yeah.
Not necessarily like things that are going to hurt players, but are just going to be like, what is wrong with you? Why are you doing it? Like, just like this is not basketball. And you know, the guy would just smile and be like, yeah, okay. But so they would try all these ways to piss guys off. And even to the point of, you know, there were players who were known for, you know, they'll grab a import player's butt, or grab even like, you know, sort of down near his balls to mess with him. I mean, there's if people want to look it up, there's a video. Usually it's a Mark Yee, Anthony Grundy, or Mark Yi Sundot, S-U-N-D-O-T, Scandal. It's a clip on YouTube where you see they caught it on tape. The defender, Mark Yi, was being posted up by Anthony Grundy, who was playing for a team out here. And in the middle of Anthony Grundy's move, Yi reaches under between his legs and just sort of like grabbed. You see him just get a handful, and everyone Grundy turns around and looks at him like he's crazy. The refs call it. He does get a technical for it. Mark Yi in this case. But it was, there are stories throughout history of players who could do that. Players who there. This was in the 80s. There was a player known for being able to, spit a very fine stream of saliva between his two front teeth and aim it at players on the free throw line. I mean,
I can't throw you off.
ways to mess with people. And foreign players often had to deal with the worst of it because, it was the same way that it can be difficult to referee a player like Shaq or Giannis in the NBA, where it's sort of like they're physically so overpowering, you don't know exactly what, defenders get away with fouls against them that they wouldn't let other guys get away with, because it's sort of like, well, he's so big, he can take it. There's a little bit of that here where, players will hack the living heck out of an import and just sort of be like, well, deal with it, big guy.
Yeah. How was it with fans? Like they are like very loyal to their teams, from what I understood reading your book. To their local players, how is it with, or how, no, let's rephrase, like how loyal are they to their teams and to their local players, and what role do foreign players play then, and how do they take them in?
There's an interesting dynamic with fandom in the PBA where there is extreme, just over the top loyalty and love for one team in particular, which is it's owned by or sponsored by a brand of local gin called Ginebra. And over the years, they've been called the Ginebra Gin Kings. Now they're just the Barangay Ginebra Kings. Barangay means like neighborhood. They are the most – when you go to their games, the entire arena – is filled with their fans, even though, there's another team playing that theoretically has fans too. Because also one thing to note about the PBA, there's no home and away. All the games of all the teams generally take place in Metro Manila, unless they're playing sort of a special out of town game. Uh-huh. So but basically it's sort of, the arena is open for fans of either team to show up. Whoever can bring more gets essentially a home court advantage. Mm-hmm. And this Ginebra team always has crowds of about 20 to 25,000 in like rabid fans screaming, chanting Ginebra, Ginebra, like whenever they go on a run. There's this whole history to that, how it developed over the years. It's related to the most famous and popular player in Philippine basketball history who had a career that began in college in the 60s and was still playing professionally until 1998, when he only stopped playing to become a senator. His name was Senator Robert Sonny Jaworski. He's still alive. His name is Robert Jaworski. And he was this super passionate, when he was at his peak in the 80s, had won an MVP, was never considered the most talented player in the league, but was up there, was always a top five guy. But it was really his attitude. He was considered extremely good looking, and he was tough and mean and fearless, and people just loved him. I mean, and there's one game where he gets, it's sort of like the Paul Pierce game, except legit. no bathroom breaks playing? Or whatever.
What was,
where, they were playing against, a really strong, they were playing against a really strong opponent that was actually a lot better than them. He gets smacked in the face and has to leave and gets, I think, like, you know, 18 stitches, came back for the fourth quarter and led a comeback for the team. And you know, it was one of these sort of legend making moments that people told their kids about it. You know, the story gets bigger every time someone tells it. You know, like, he played, you know, it's like Willis Reed combined with Paul Pierce combined with the flu game, you know, all in one. And and he was already a hero before that, you know. But so anyway, because and the other aspect of what made him so popular was he was one of these players who considered it his like his sworn duty to spend time with and be kind to every single fan who ever approached him. And he every teammate of his, all when he was a player coach, the players who played for him, they all say that after every practice, he would not leave the gym until every fan who showed up to get his autograph or to shake his hand or to take a picture or anything, he would spend time with all of them. He knew their names. The fans who kept coming back over years, he would bring, you know, he would know their birthdays and have like spaghetti, because Filipino culture, it is good luck to eat noodles on your birthday, because it's like a long noodle. It means long life.
Okay. Yeah.
So you get spaghetti or pancit noodles for your birthday. He'd have, so he really, you know, he had this close relationship where he was as loyal to his fans as they were to him. And because of that, and he also made the whole team, all of his players, do the same thing, even if they couldn't quite keep up with him. He wouldn't let them ever sort of snub a fan. So it was part of the deal to play for him. And because of that, and he was there for so long, you know, from basically 1981, this team was its first year, until 1998, when he stopped being the player coach. His son was playing for him, and he would still check himself into games at age 52, just because.
Wow.
And so, you know, but through all that time, you know, people grew up with him, and he was the fandom he created, people then passed down to their generation, to their kids. And it still exists, even though he's, you know, it's been 25 years since then. Because of that, his team is still the most beloved in the league. And you see, and it still is the one that has the most loyal fans that will, you know, who show up for every game. You know, are waiting to see the players after every single game, and you know, it's really it is the national team within the league, you know, besides the real national team. It's over time, that's honestly only become even stronger. Like, there were two or three other teams that had similar followings when I was, you know, back in, say, 2005 to 2008, when I was researching the book. Now, you know, almost two decades later, it feels like Ginebra's lead on the rest of the league in terms of fan loyalty and devotion is almost, it's like it's doubled it. You know, it's like they've lapped the field. Okay. Uh-huh. So it's really, and to the point where I don't know that the league, I mean, it's hard to tell what the PBA considers a challenge, but if I were in charge of the PBA, I would be worried that Ginebra is so popular that the other teams can't even gain traction at this point. And I don't know how you build up organic support for another team, because it's like there's so much behind this one squad. So that is one of the interesting, I warn people when they reach out to me, you know, friends, or sometimes people will just email and say, "Hey, Rafe, you know, I'm traveling to the Philippines. I read your book. I really love basketball. I want to check out a PBA game." And I'm like, it's great. Do not go to a game in the middle of the afternoon, you know, on a Wednesday, between two teams that don't have the same following, because you'll think I made everything in my book up, because of, like, they'll be like, you know, 100 people in the crowd, and it'll feel like, you know, this is the whole everything I was local writing gym about doesn't exist. Yeah, exactly. But if you go to a Ginebra game, it'll feel like, you know, one of the most intense sporting environments you've ever seen. I remember actually my father only visited me once when I was here, which is fine. I mean, that's plenty. I you know, it's like he's in his 70s now. He looks very hot and uncomfortable. Yeah. But the one time he got to visit me, I took him to a Ginebra game. And not only that, I took him into the standing room area part of the arena where they don't even sell tickets. It's, you know, people line up about 2 hours before the game. And then an hour before they open they take down the rope and everyone just runs in and tries to get a seat. And we stood in the space between seats there for an entire game. And my dad was like, at times, grabbing me and saying, is this arena going to collapse? Because like, you know, the platform was shaking, like people were jumping up and down and like you could feel it vibrate, the concrete vibrating up there. And he was like, are you sure that we're not going to die tonight? And I was like, Dad, this building has been here since 1975. It's held up, you know, I think we're okay. But it was okay. That's how intense it can feel.
Wow. And are they always winning then? Or is it like the competition fairly leveled?
They go back and forth. I think they suffer from being the public favorites sometimes in that like – they have a lot of resources, they can buy players, but they had a period where I guess they sort of, you can compare it to when like the New York Knicks were you know, extreme, you were kept, you know, oh, let's go you know, sign Stephon or trade for Stephon Marbury towards the end of his career. Oh, that didn't work out. How about Steve Francis towards the end of his career? Oh, that didn't work out. You know, it's like you keep chasing, you know, how about, you know, Penny Hardaway and Tracy McGrady at the end of their careers.
Or not waiting for Melo, you know, until his contract runs off. I'd rather trade for him half a year before.
let's give away all of our players for Carmelo and then have a decent team rather than a really good one. There have been times in Ginebra's history where, you know, the management has searched for quick fixes and made those kind of similar personnel decisions that you know, made them, you know, sort of a mediocre team instead of one of the best ones. In recent years, they've been consistently one of the best. So they sort of have righted the ship, and they are generally competing for championships. They've never had that one big man, Junmar Fajardo, who I mentioned earlier, the really dominant local player. So he plays on a team owned by the same corporation, I might add, which is the San Miguel Beermen. That has actually helped build up a rivalry between those sort of sister teams in recent years, where they often find themselves facing off for a championship where, you know, it's like Junmar and his team and San Miguel versus Ginebra and the Wild fans. You know, so Ginebra has its ups and downs, but right now they're very, very good.
But a good rivalry seems to be good for the league then. So that is going into a good direction.
Absolutely. But the league wants to get that team in the finals every time, which is not really you don't want the league to have that incentive, right? I mean, people are hardened basketball fans like anyone else in the world and have a cynical streak to them. And when they see a call go for that team's, you know, go that team's way in a big game that, you know, so, you know, forces a game seven or, you know, puts them in, you know, gives them a chance to advance in the playoffs. It's like, oh yeah, well, they need Ginebra in the finals. They need Ginebra in the finals.
True. That may raise questions. Such calls.
Yeah. Yes.
So from the arena to, like, we've been going on for a while, but I just, like, briefly I want to touch on the streets, on the street courts in Manila, because it's like the famous picture. One of the pictures is on the cover of your book with the guy dunking in flip-flops and no shirt on. If you Google Philippines basketball, you come up with pictures of like courts randomly in the streets, sometimes just like on literally on the street, and cars either waiting or the players making room for the cars in order for them to pass and then play on. Is there really a court on every corner? And is there, when people start playing, will there be people showing up and either try to play themselves or just watch them play?
For me, I would say that is not an exaggeration at all from what I've found living here over the years. It's one of my favorite things to do in the country, is just to walk, you know, to sort of walk through a new area, whether it's in, you know, in Manila, in an urban area, or in the province, and just, you know, finding all the different little ways that basketball reveals it to yourself, it reveals it to you, you know, as you walk along. And like, the closer you look, the more you'll see basketball, whether it's, little half court set up, on down an alley, or, you know, full courts, or sometimes just, you know, a painting of a basketball player on the side of a building, cars riding by one of the main forms of public transportation traditionally, and going way back in the Philippines, it's called the jeepney. And it's a, you know, it's an extended, diesel passenger jeep that, you know, has two benches on the inside that, you know, you hail and jump in and ride it for until you want to get off, and you clink the top of the roof and say, I want to get off. And the sides of those are always decorated, but with whatever the driver cares most about. A lot of the time you'll see pictures of his children and his wife and stuff like that on it. One of the other common things is basketball. You will see, you're walking along and you see a jeep fly by with the entire, for you, it will, you know, the core of the 1990s, you know, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, yeah. Chicago Bulls, their faces will all be like, you know, Scottie, nice. Michael, Scottie, Horace Grant, Cartwright, you know, Paxton, Phil, you know, you see them all there, or you'll see the Showtime Lakers, or you see like one that is just all Kobe'd out, you know, like, you know, that you see, so you see basketball coming out through references, cultural references. You see it, you see courts everywhere. Some of my favorite ones I remember seeing was like, I was walking through a really, really, like, you know, dense urban area in Caloocan City, which is like a northern part of Metro Manila. And the street I was walking on was as tight as an alley, you know, it's like maybe two people could walk by side and fill up the street. Some, you know, sort of teenage guys had rigged two long metal hooks, kind of like a big clothes hanger type setup, you know? And on that they had affixed a small backboard and rim. And so people here, you know, for security often have iron bars on their windows. And so they were moving up and down the street to wherever there was some space to have a little half court game, like a little one-on-one. And they would hook their metal thing and hang it onto people's, iron bars, and then just have a hoop hanging there, and they shoot for 10 minutes and then move it to another spot. And I'm just like, this is so ingenious. This is so cool.
Multiple hoop.
And there's one I saw. I was here earlier this year staying in a rural part of the Philippines, Romblon province. And I took a walk through, you know, it basically feels like you're walking on a path through the jungle. And you're, you know, it's like, you know, really dense forest. You might see, you see like big lizards and weird stuff. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, you know, you go up a hill and the road hooks to the right, and there's this clearing and just this gorgeous dirt half court with a red, white, and blue net with like fringe at the bottom. A backboard is like four pieces of wood, very old wood, nailed together. And it's just sort of like this magical, it's like, you know, it feels like, you know, in you're watching a movie and someone is walking through the desert and they find the oasis. This is, it yeah. feels like, it feels like stumbling upon the basketball version of that. And you really,
nice.
If you, for people who, you know, have that sort of adventurous streak and visit the country, I think it's one of the best ways to sort of get a taste of basketball culture here, because it really is, the more you walk around, the closer you look, the more you'll see basketball in the most, in every little corner, hiding and being played or being watched or something.
That is so cool. And can you just join a game whenever you want to? As a,
yes,
as someone visiting?
Absolutely. I mean, in some cases, you know, depending on how you look and your height, you it will be hard for you to you know, to decline joining a game. You know, if you if they see you, if you are of, you know, roughly, you know, sports playing age, right, if you're in your anywhere from 20 to, you know, a youthful 40 something, and if you're, you know, tall by local standards, which could be like basically 5'10" and up, you know, people are going to see you and be like, you know, hey, do you play, man? You know, and like, want to play? You know, I mean, when I was younger, people would, you know, I'd walk by a court and, you know, I'm 6'3". And when I'd be in my 20s and I'd walk by, you know, and it's, like everyone here, I've worn basketball shorts casually pretty much whenever, in every, yeah. you know, moment of relaxation. Throughout my entire life, you know, or anytime that I don't have to be, yeah, anytime that I don't have to be wearing pants for some reason, I'm probably wearing basketball shorts. And it's the same here, but you know, I walk by wearing basketball shorts. I'm in my 20s, I'm 6'3". People would see me, hey, you know, throw me a ball and be like, dunk, man, dunk. And I'm like, I was never really that great of a jumper. Like, I'll get this on the rim and miss if you want. And they're like, yeah, dunk. And it's sort of like, and they miss it. You're like, oh, you know, like, but yeah, if you're certainly, you can join. And on top of that, you know, if you look like someone who plays, you know, you're going to be invited and almost demanded cool. to get out there.
And did you manage to dunk, like, maybe on a lower hoop sometime?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, there, you know, I mean, certainly, like, you know, when I first came out here, if we had and it's pretty common for guys to be playing with, you know, sometime, or younger kids will have, like, those miniature balls that are easy to mm-hmm. palm. I would dunk mm-hmm. that. You know, it was basically, I also have small hands, so I can't palm a ball. So having poor hops and having to go up with two hands always, you know, was basically a killer for me, you know, doing any consistent dunking in my career. But you know, yeah, the miniature balls, I could dunk on. And it's also common when you're walking around, you will see, like, for example, the photo you mentioned of the shirtless kid, you know, kids, the kids playing, the shirtless guy dunking on a homemade hoop. I mean, that, you know, he's definitely using a smaller than regulation ball. And that hoop is probably 6, 7, or 8 feet up. You know, that was not like a regulation basket in height or in any other way. And so there were times when I'd walk by a game like that and guys are, you know, and folks, you know, guys would, you know, tell me to join, and I would. And on those, I mean, you know, it's a little embarrassing to sort of talk about like it was real, because deep down I know it wasn't, but it felt like I was you're playing 3-on-3 with a miniature ball, and you're just like, you know, like two dribbles and like yamming it on people on 8-foot rims, and a crowd forms and people are like ooing and eyeing, and it's like it's amazing that, like, on a completely artificial sort of, that is not real basketball, that's not going to get me anywhere you know, in a competitive game. However, it felt so real, man. It felt real to me. It really does go to your head fast. You're like, you know, pumped up dunking in front of people.
Maybe to wrap things up, you talked about your book Pacific Rims as like a love letter to the Philippines. What made you fall in love?
I think it was, you know, it was one, I think it starts with basketball. Mm-hmm. because, you know, that, like I said at the very beginning, you know, I thank you to basketball when we're sitting there at dinner for sort of being with me my entire life, this sort of the thing that has given me joy all along the way. And finding this country where it felt like literally, and it's not literally, but almost literally everyone I met had a similar love for the game. It just really, it was their special thing. And being able to share that with so many people anywhere you went, really made it easy to sort of, start, assimilating and learning more about Philippine culture, you know, but then beyond that, you know, I made an effort to learn Tagalog and I still speak well. And then I also, you know, studied the history and did a lot of, you know, and really, I guess, you know, assimilated beyond basketball. And that was something that, really, I don't know, it just became who I am. I can't even imagine the sort of what my life would be like if I hadn't moved here when I was 23 and sort of had, you know, those really crucial early 20s years when you're, I mean, for Americans, it's like, that's when you're first really out on your own. You're out of college. You don't, you know, you're feeding yourself. There's no dining hall. Mm-hmm. And it, at least for me, I felt like I came of age and sort of became an adult in the Philippines. I've carried around the country with me ever since in ways that frankly can be hard to explain to people back home in America who are like, what are you talking about? Why do you keep going back there? You know, mm-hmm. but it's because it's a part of who I am now. And it really, I'm so grateful to everyone who, you know, sort of accepted me along the way and made that journey possible.
Those are some beautiful last words. So thank you very much for doing this, Rafe, and taking so much time. Apart from your book, Pacific Rims, which, again, I highly recommend, and your other book, Basketball, A Love Affair, which matches what we just talked about for the past roughly 2 hours, that you wrote with Jackie McMullen, right, and Dan Cloris. Is there any other way our listeners can read you, hear you, listen to you, watch you, that you'd like to share?
Sure. Yeah, well, look, I mean, I am on social media. You know, if you look up my name, I'll probably come up on Instagram and Twitter, and you can, I don't post as much as I did when I was younger. Yeah. I'm getting old, but, still, you know, I'm still out there. And, I think I really love, you know, I'm thankful that you watched, Hoop Nation. There's another show called, Pinoy Hoops that we did a little bit mm-hmm. before then. I loved working on those shows. It was a chance to keep sort of extending the work that started in Pacific Rims and telling, Philippine basketball stories. And we got to travel the country a little bit and visit some incredible places and see these great stories about basketball out here. You know, and those are all free on YouTube now. So if this stuff was interesting and you want to actually get a visual of it, those shows, I think I love those people. That's a great thing to check out. You know, I think, hopefully I want to keep writing. I work as an editor now. So, you know, I have like, unfortunately, or fortunately, fortunately I have work. Unfortunately, that work is not as a full-time writer, but I always find ways to write and come back because it's sort of part of what I, you know, I can't not do it. It always comes back.
Once a writer, always a writer, right?
Sure.
Cool. Thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of the World Cup. Hopefully you'll witness the German team winning a medal. And yeah, take care. Enjoy Manila.
Thank you so much, Max. You can tell it doesn't really take a lot to wind me up talking about this. I really love it.
I sure could tell. That was great fun. Thank you.